Welcome to a new episode of The Brand Called You. Today I have a very, very old friend and someone who's been an absolute icon in the corporate world. Krishan Dhawan, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Mr. Krishan.
Krishan is from St. Stephen's College. He's from IIM Ahmedabad. He was managing director of Bank of America. Then he was managing director of Oracle Corporation. He's founder of Impact. Until very recently, he was CEO of Shakti Sustainable Energy Foundation. My God, what an amazing career you had. Krishan, tell us a little bit about your early career with Bank of America.
Sure.
And then we'll move on to all the new good things you're doing.
Certainly. So it was, I guess, the longest and the sort of most important formative part of my working life. I spent 23 years there. I joined straight out of business school with, you know, obviously no experience and, you know, a lot of expectations and hopes for learning and progressing. And it was, you know, with hindsight, you know, a wonderful place to start. I think the banking industry was probably the right choice for me. It provided a very broad platform in terms of understanding how companies work without being too narrowly focused on any one industry. So I got the chance to learn a lot, travel. I was assigned to different cities in India, to different cities across the world. Functionally also, you know, pursued different functions within the bank. You know, I started in Delhi in what we call relationship banking. So my initial career was in the branches, customer-facing roles in Delhi, Calcutta, Bombay. And then I started moving overseas, and I was in Malaysia, in Hong Kong. And then I finally ended up in Los Angeles. And moved from sort of profit center roles in Hong Kong, to which was our regional office, to looking after regional issues around credit risk and exposure and marketing and strategy. And then ended up with in the US for 5 years with managing a significant profit center as well. So look at it with great fondness.
And how many years did you spend with it?
23 years.
Oh, that's a long stint.
Yeah, that's
a long stint. And then from there you moved to technology.
Yes.
And it, you know, when I've known you for a long time, yes, and I often wondered, what was the transition from banking to technology?
You know, it was, I would say, serendipity. It wasn't a plan. It wasn't something that I had sort of chalked out and said, you know, set my eyes on, this is what I'm going to. Essentially, it happened because I moved back to India. At that stage, I moved back because my kids, I wanted them to spend some time in India in school before they went off to college. They'd been overseas for many years. My father was alone, and I wanted the opportunity to spend some time with him. So when I got back, the opportunities in banking at that stage, you know, having done what I'd done in other parts of the world, there really weren't that many, and especially not at all in Delhi. And this opportunity came knocking, and honestly, I knew nothing about the subject. But I give full credit to the people who were, you know, interviewing me and who took a bet on me. And we knew that pretty soon we'd know very quickly whether this is going to work or not. And fortunately, it did. I spent 5.5 years there. It was quite a learning. Apart from learning about databases, ERPs, middleware, and software of other kinds that this company was sort of a leader in. It was a very different culture from banking. It was very transactional, very sales oriented. You were essentially, you know, I was managing the customer facing organization, not the technology development. It was a completely a different breed of very effective, very successful people, but whose motivation was numbers. But I relied on what I had learned in terms of how to manage teams, manage people, manage relationships. As to reflect, there's a quote from Samuel Johnson about a walking dog. And it goes that it isn't amazing. The amazing thing isn't how well he's doing it, but that he's doing it at all. So I sort of reflect on that, on my own self, that it wasn't that it was getting along quite well, but the fact that I was even doing it. And it just, I think, proved to me, I mean, obviously there's no substitute to technical knowledge, but there's very smart people out there who have that technical knowledge. that certain, I think, management principles do translate across sector. And as I mentioned, it's about relationships, people, yeah, and understanding the business model. And in some ways, I would say, ignorance also helped, because I needed to, for my own sake, distill something fairly complex, the value proposition that the company was trying to offer, into something that was understandable, mm-hmm, first to me, and then to the non-technical clients that I would also meet. I mean, our sales teams would be meeting the chief technology officers, but in my role, I had to spend more time with CEOs, yeah, and CFOs, yeah, and explain to them in simple terms. And, you know, it worked really well.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, I remember when you had joined Oracle, someone had asked me this question, and I said, listen, I moved after 17 years with ITC into aerospace. I didn't know what was aerospace, yes, but I led teams, yes, launched huge satellites, yes, for 8 years.
Yes.
And I commented to somebody, I said, you know, Oracle will change when Krishan goes there, because he'll bring a very different perspective which a tech company needs.
Right.
So I think what you're saying is absolutely right.
And, you know, like many industries, it was inbred.
Correct.
There's nothing wrong, yeah, with that. So, yeah, you know, when I started talking about relationships versus transactions, you know, people's eyes would sort of, yeah, glaze over initially, but, you know, I persisted.
Yeah.
And and it was an interesting time in Oracle's history. It was going through some major acquisitions, mm-hmm, as well.
Mm-hmm.
That added further complexity, because we were acquiring companies globally, mm-hmm, and we had to fold them in. And, you know, it was always a large base for their operations. So I think when I joined, the company, not directly working for me, but the company had about 5,000 people. By the time I left, we had 20,000.
Wow.
So it was,
wow, that was
not significant.
So, you know, moving on, I mean, you know, when I was reading about you, in 2003 is when you first got involved in the NGO space.
Yes.
You know, I think, and that was when you founded Impact.
Yes.
So tell us a little bit about, sure, Impact.
So it was not just me. It was me and a group of, sure, classmates, mm-hmm, from IIM Ahmedabad. So we got together after a very long time on our 25th anniversary, which was 2003.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we had spent years working on our careers, etc., and had, you know, all sort of reached a certain stage in life.
Mm-hmm.
So between being more reflective and possibly too many drinks while, mm-hmm, you're, mm-hmm, having, you know, a party,
yeah,
everybody said, we got to do something, and we got to do something to give back.
Mm-hmm.
I think the remarkable thing is for this initiative that it lasted.
Mm-hmm.
It took shape.
Mm-hmm.
It took form. And it thrived.
Mm-hmm.
Because when I meet many other alumni from either business schools or engineering schools who tend to have, you know, regular alumni meetings more than, mm-hmm, say, you know, colleges, they all say, yeah, they're resolved to do something, but it doesn't get off the ground.
Yeah.
So I think it's a credit to the group of people I was working with,
mm-hmm,
that we stuck to it. It wasn't easy, you know, for a variety of reasons. And, you know, we have a functioning and thriving organization, and we've gone through some major transitions where the initial group has now chosen to step back. The initial management group has also stepped away. We've professionalized, and we've actually inducted a group of people 10 years junior to us,
mm-hmm,
from the same institute,
okay,
to sort of take over as part of the succession planning. So essentially what the organization, and it took a while for us to decide, it's easy to say we'll do something, mm-hmm, to give back, we'll do something worthwhile, but there's so many things you can do.
Sure.
And I think the important thing is to have, you know, a narrow and clear focus of what you're trying to achieve and why and what were the outcomes. So our decision at that time was what we could probably do best for society was to address the issue of illiteracy among women in certain communities,
mm-hmm,
in sections of society. Because we believed that by educating the half of the population that wasn't getting this opportunity,
mm-hmm,
the long-term benefits would be huge.
Would be immense. Cool.
So we started with modest ambitions, was to impart literacy, read, write, do some arithmetic,
mm-hmm,
to young girls who were out of school and were not likely to be put into school for social, family, economic reasons in rural communities. But the biggest learning for us over, you know, after we completed 5 years and 10, then now 15, is how much more we've achieved than just imparting literacy, and how much we've changed these young women in their own eyes, very importantly, in the eyes of their family, in the eyes of their community. You know, they've really given them a sense of self, a sense of what they can achieve, you know, and, you know, what they can aspire to. Mm-hmm. And now most of the girls, our program was primary, grades 1 to 5. Almost all of them go to middle and high school, mm-hmm. and many of them go to college. Mm-hmm. And
you see them through the entire?
We formally see them only to their first 5-year period, okay. But informally we keep track because through the community. Mm-hmm. And our biggest, greatest delight is that some of our own products are now coming back to teach at our own establishments, you know, sort of completes sort of circle for us and validates that. And keeping our management hats on, we wanted to create a model that was scalable and replicable. Mm-hmm. So we started with about 300 girls in some villages in Rajasthan, in Alwar district. And now we have almost 50,000 girls in 11 states. And it's a model that, you know we can scale and we can replicate. We only go where there's a need. So we, you know, we do an assessment and see where there's a gap between male and female literacy levels. And it's just been wonderful. And the most wonderful experience is actually visiting a village and visiting these girls. And not only the girls, their mothers and their fathers and the pride with which.
So a lot of the girls who you initially taught.
Yeah.
They must be now becoming responsible members of the society.
Exactly.
Have you got any examples of some successes?
So one ongoing, I think, success is, and one of the ills that impacts the communities we work in, is child marriage or marrying girls at a young age.
Yeah.
And the amazing thing is that once the parent puts the girls in school, that's taken off the table. Mm. And we've seen even within the same family, if there are two sisters, the one who isn't going to school may get married at 12, 13 and have her first child at 15.
And that's still prevalent going on?
It's still prevalent. And, you know, we're sitting here in modern Gurgaon. Mm-hmm. You can go an hour and a half from Gurgaon into Mewat. It's a different world.
I agree.
So, you know, keeping girls unmarried until they're of the right age, you know, having their first child until they're the right age. And then many of them... would could have never aspired, their mothers certainly could never have aspired to working, you know, they're teaching, they're joining the police, you know, they're taking on jobs. And I think, you know, they're becoming mothers themselves.
Yeah.
And as educated mothers, I think their approach to hygiene, to nutrition, you know, would be very different to how, you know, they were brought up.
Amazing. And impact with its spelling, I just assumed was IIM.
Exactly.
Initially, I thought it was a mnemonic, but then I said...
No, it was a play on the fact we were from IMPACT and trying to make it... Sorry, we were from IIM and trying to make an impact.
Okay.
So some people pronounce it IIMPACT, and I said, actually, it's, you know, that's okay to say IIMPACT, but actually it's
IIMPACT. Wonderful. And, you know, how does someone get associated with this organization, either directly involved or as a donor?
So, I mean, as a donor, it's very simple. Okay. You know, we have a website, we have portals. If you're a resident Indian, if you're a foreigner, you know, there are different gateways for that. You know, for an NGO, funding is lifeblood, you know, and it's always a challenge. There's one thing we can never take for granted. We started small with, you know, friends and family and ourselves. But fortunately, we've been able to grow our funding base, both within India and offshore. So, you know, we welcome, you know, so people can fund, you know, Give India and other platforms, or go directly to the website, iambact.org. In terms of other kinds of involvement, you know, experience shows us that people do express it, but then... What we need is sustained you know, both in terms of it's continuous and there's a certain sort of quantum.
Correct.
It's very difficult for any organization to accommodate, you know, people who just sort of drop in at will and say, how can I be of help?
And become an advisor.
Yeah. And we have enough advisors. We're a group of MBAs.
Correct.
We have just... more advice from each other than we need.
I agree with you.
That being said, we've selectively take young people on for a couple of months of people, you know, still in school, about to go to college. You know, they want to sort of come and give full-time, you know, input for 6 weeks, mm-hmm. 8 weeks. Mm-hmm. You know, there's always a way. Mm-hmm. But just dropping in for advice.
Yeah. Yeah. Understand. Not completely understand, you know, because a lot of people do keep expressing the need.
Yes.
And I understand fully, because I tell people, you can either contribute with your checkbook,
yes,
which is one way to do it, or get fully involved.
Yes. Fully.
Don't give lip service.
Yeah, fully is important.
Right? I agree. Yeah. So, Krishan, moving on to your next initiative,
yes,
which is the Shakti Sustainable Energy Foundation.
Yes.
Talk to us a little bit about.
Sure. So that actually, I think it's obviously the most current. Mm-hmm. I just stepped down after 7.5 years, and probably the most interesting thing I've done, mm-hmm. because, I mean, at the end of the day, you know, be it banking or software, are fairly established lines of work, and a lot of people do this. So this was new in many respects, both for me personally and also for the environment in which we work in. So firstly, it was working in climate change mitigation, mm-hmm. and clean energy.
Okay.
Things like renewable energy, mm-hmm. energy efficiency, sustainable transportation, etc. And two, it was about working at the policy level, in terms of trying to work at the macro level, try to create the right policy framework so the right investments take place. So we were a foundation. We got money and we gave away money. We weren't what I'd say a passive foundation. We were a very active foundation in terms of we helped design programs and work with our partners that were typically think tanks and in other NGOs. And we also were involved in the advocacy. So when we produce some intellectual output as a result of the funding investment we made. Mm-hmm. We were very much part of the process to get it, you know, buy in from the government, get them to understand what the object here was, mm-hmm. and, you know, how they could help. So when I started in 2012, this organization had just been set up. It was a fledgling, small organization, not very large budgets, mm-hmm. or staff. And climate, if you sort of think back in 2012, was not a subject that either most people understood or took very seriously.
Correct.
For better and for worse, that situation has changed today.
Okay.
I think people realize the severe impact climate is having on our lives, and the urgent need to act.
Yeah.
But that's recent, in the last few years. Mm. And in India in particular, it wasn't a subject that, you know, got any traction.
Hmm.
So, you know, one was jumping into an area that nobody cared about,
yeah,
or understood, hmm. and wondered, you know, what the heck is going on.
Hmm.
So I think fortunately, with a lot of, you know, again, perseverance, you know, building a great team, developing great partners, having good funding support,
hmm.
we have been able to sort of create awareness, create ambition to do something, mm-hmm. and then, you know, incentivize action, mm-hmm. which were the three things. So I think over the last few years, there's been far more engagement on and ambition and action on renewable energy, on efficiency, on clean transportation, on the need to work on climate change, because it isn't a foreign concept.
Correct.
That's, you know, it's something that we, as actually India, is probably the most susceptible to. And we have to balance our development, our needs and aspirations, which are paramount.
Mm.
But one can do so in a way that's conscious of the climate impact it makes.
Okay. And when you talk about advocacy in all these areas, what is the process that you would follow? I mean, would you just reach out to the government? Or
typically.
Have some activists?
So, no, our approach, there are two approaches. One is an activist approach, and one is, you know, going straight to the policymaker. Mm-hmm. Our assessment was that for a variety of reasons, going through to impact the policymaker was probably the most appropriate, mm-hmm. one for us. Because there was a lot of the areas we worked in, there was no policy.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't as if there was a bad policy or the wrong policy.
Mm-hmm.
Because they were so new.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, people Who knew solar energy would be, you know, a real viable alternative to conventional energy? So, you know, there was just no provision. So our ambition was to create, you know, there was this white space to fill in the gaps in that white space. And for that, I must give credit, especially in the current government, for the receptiveness. You know, people, you have to obviously establish credibility. There's an underlying unease in our system with foreign funded initiatives, and we were essentially foreign funded philanthropically. So one has to establish one's bona fides that the agenda we were looking at are consistent with India's agendas of sustainable development, energy security, and growth. So one had to first work at the federal level, which is where, you know, overarching policies need to be put into place. And then as those spaces got filled in, started working more at the state and at the city government. And you know, it wasn't always easy, but over time, I think it worked really well.
So let me move on to another section of our program. Yes. That is a few questions about you and, you know, but even before that, you and I are of a similar vintage. That's and, you know, there are a lot of people in this country who are now reaching 60 or 58 or 59. And retirement is something that people in India don't like to talk about. It's almost like a taboo. You did a phenomenal transition from the corporate world into an NGO space and are now involved in so many things. And yet I'm sure you know so many people who are not preparing themselves. What would your advice be to people who are in their early 50s, mid 50s, who probably are going to have 30, 35 years ahead and are not ready?
Yeah, and I think those are excellent points. I think many of us are colored by, you know, the experience of our parents who did retire at 60.
Correct.
You know, you know, it wasn't really, you know,
there were not too many options.
There weren't too many options. It was also a mindset issue. It was, you know, the whole system expected you to do that. So I think many of us, I hope, are far healthier today, this Absolutely. Generation, or at least more conscious. So, you know, we have the physical abilities. Okay. And as important, I think one has the mental desire, you know, to continue to be active and productive. And I really believe that if you want to remain healthy in the complete sense, you need to have both that physical and that mental sort of engagement. And without the mental engagement, you will start impacting.
Yeah.
But I think different people can react to, you know, age and time differently, or react to the specter of retirement separately. I think some need a narrow, well understood, regimented sort of routine, and some, you know, are quite happy with the freedom they have, because again, I would hope that by this age, your material needs are pretty much taken care of. Your kids, you know, the usual
settled,
thing,
yeah.
Settled, you know, your parents, you know, maybe around, may not, but, you know, so you're actually, it's quite liberating,
Absolutely
honestly,
right.
You know?
Yes.
So I think one should view it as a liberation and not as a sentence, you know, that you have to serve out, you know. So I think it's up to each individual to, and it's okay, because I think most people can work till they're 70 or 75. There's no reason to stop at 60.
Sure.
Health doesn't come in the way. But, you know, how you define work is, I think, up to you. And I would encourage people to use your imagination and pursue things that, you know, that will keep them engaged.
Yeah.
And often you say, oh, I wish I had the time. If I had the time, I would have done this, you know. We can say woulda, shoulda, coulda, you know, something. But now you do. So, you know, now it's in your own control. And, you know.
Yeah, that's very, very well said. Because, you know, it's incredible. You spoke about health, etc. And I've often said that retirement or superannuation has nothing to do with you. It has to do with the policies of your employer.
Yeah.
And given good health, we probably will live till 90.
Yeah.
So your life post 60 will be almost equal to your working life.
Exactly.
What are you going to do?
Exactly. So you really need to start thinking about that. Correct. And it's a wide open canvas.
Correct.
And it's up to you to, you know, set the scene.
Correct. So next question too is, you know, a lot of people, and you spent so much time with the NGOs. A lot of people say that, you know, when I retire, I want to do something with NGOs.
Right.
You have spoken about getting fully involved.
Right.
But any advice to them? Should they start their own? Should they join someone new?
Again, I think, you know, all of the above. I think starting anything new, be it a business venture or an NGO, is tough. You need a lot of focus, a lot of energy, and a lot of perseverance. But if there's a niche that you believe you can best fill, and that, you know, nobody around you is doing it, and it's something that you're passionate about, you know, go for it. But it isn't easy. It's as difficult, or in some ways more difficult, than setting up a business. Because in business, as long as your revenues cover your costs, you know, you're okay. But in an NGO, you're always looking for funding. You have to make a case to other people because, you know, by definition, I'm assuming it isn't self-funded. You need external funding. So actually, you know, if I can digress, you know, one hears about incubators a lot.
Yep.
And incubators are often associated with technology companies and now with impact investing.
Yep.
But in my days at Shakti, you know, we were dependent on NGOs to be our grantees to whom we could give money to get a work. And one of our biggest constraints was there weren't enough NGOs working in the area that we wanted to work in.
Okay.
So we actually set up an incubator at the Indian School of Business and did a call for proposals and got people who had good ideas and wanted to set up an NGO. But it was actually very difficult because if you have a good business idea, you can get investors. Nowadays, we have a good impact idea, you can get investors, but and help. Investors is after you get the help. But if you looked around, there was, if you wanted to set up an NGO and you wanted some assistance, there was nowhere to go. So I think, you know, there's a lot that can be done. But, you know, there's so many large established organizations that are doing lots of good work. You can take your pick, health, education, you know, what have you, climate, energy. And, you know, they're looking for good people. I mean, I know having run and staffed one, if I could get, again, commitment's important. If somebody who's 60 says, look, these are the skills I bring. It could be in finance, it could be in administration, it could be in sales or whatever. But I guarantee you that I'll be with you for 5 years. Or even better, 10, you know, would you have an opening for me? And this is all I've achieved in life. You'd say, yes, of course, because, you know, it's the social sector doesn't rely on its great salaries to attract people, right?
Yeah.
So if you have an individual who salary isn't the main motivation, I think, you know, the organizations would be very grateful and happy to have that sort of.
Very interesting. No, that I think that's a very, very interesting comment you've made, and I'm sure a lot of people will hear this. You know, if you have skills, come out and make the offer.
Yeah.
But as long as you're willing to commit time,
yes,
I think that's possible.
Yeah, because it's just like, you know, when you ran a company, you want, if you hired somebody, you wanted that person there. You know, it wasn't that when he felt like it, he'd come in.
Yeah.
When he didn't, you know, he wouldn't come in.
True. So, Krishan, my last question to you. You know. And I ask this question to all my guests because the people who hear us somehow believe that successful individuals don't have failures.
Yes.
My question to you is, what have been your learnings from your failures?
So I think one of my, when you go through downs, you tend to, at least I did, pick up all these sort of sayings that, you know, you tell yourself, and especially when you come out of it. But one of my favorites is that what doesn't kill you makes you stronger.
Okay.
Yeah. So, you know, I think downs as well as the ups are in everybody's fortune.
Yeah.
Some can be much more extreme and some would be less so. And I think having some down experience actually is good for you.
Correct.
It does make you stronger. Because otherwise, you know, you'd just fall apart if you didn't have that strength. And the other saying is a nautical one, that, you know, if you're sailing a boat, I'm not a sailor, but, you know, if you can't change the wind, trim your sail.
Okay.
So there again, you know, success in definition often, or failure, is often a definition that is in your own control as well.
You know,
you have to determine, and you can't rely on other people to determine it for you. And, you know, if you want to head east, but the wind's blowing in your face, then okay, let's head north, you know, and maybe we'll find, you know, land there, sort of thing.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think being hopeful, being optimistic, and hanging in there, and learning to deal with your own disappointments, I think is extremely important.
Terrific. Krishan, thank you very much.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Your words of wisdom, I think, will be heard by hundreds of thousands of people. Thank you very much and good luck.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Brand Called You podcast. Be sure to visit tbcy.in to join the conversation, access show notes, and discover fantastic bonus content. You can follow us on YouTube, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Simply search for The Brand Called You. Thank you, and see you next week.